start the talk, just a couple of things. I already mentioned, actually, but I think it's worth mentioning again. It is Karma Shila's 40th order birthday. Forty years to this very day, I believe, isn't it? Forty years to this very day.
Yeah.
He became a member of what was then the Western Buddhist Order. Now the Piratna Buddhist Order. And so very kind of interesting, really. We've got a man here who's spent practically his whole adult life involved in the Dharma teaching and all sorts of things, actually. It would take a long time to go through Karma Shila's history, so we won't do that this time. But anyway, it's lovely to have him here, and it's lovely to have him as part of the Sangha here, part of the order here, and part of the teaching team here. So I think we're very lucky to have him. Also, I'd like to, I don't know where she is. Where's the Lama now?
Here.
Oh, hello.
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 Hello there.
I say a welcome to the Lama, who's based in East London, but with the new centre, is going to be coming over and helping us out a couple of days a week. So she's going to become part of our Sangha. She's already part of our Sangha, really, because, of course, the Sangha is not restricted to a particular centre, but at the moment she's more involved in East London. So it's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. Okay,
I thought I'd start with what I started with downstairs, actually. Which, as I say, is a David White poem, Faith. I have that. Just to kind of get me going, really. Hopefully. Faith. I want to talk about faith. About the way the moon rises over cold snow, night after night. Faithful even as it fades from fullness. Slowly becoming that last impossible sliver of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I refuse it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. So when I started to think about what I wanted to say today, that poem came quite strongly to mind. And when I started thinking about it, there was a very obvious connection for me. Sangha, as probably most of you will know, is one of the so-called three treasures or jewels or refuges of Buddhism. And for people aspiring to lead a Buddhist life, we're strongly encouraged to put our faith or confidence in these three refuges. So these are the three things that Buddhism says has to be in place, really, for us to make significant progress. Yeah. I will very, very briefly, just in case there's people here that are not familiar with this idea of the three refuges, the three jewels, as it's often referred to. And in fact, what the name of the order refers to, Triratna, three jewels. I'll just very briefly mention the other two. So the first of the three jewels is the Buddha, and this refers both to the historical Buddha, and it refers to the historical Buddha and also kind of archetypal Buddhas, and it refers to them as possibilities the possibility of the human psyche, mind, you know, what is it's possible. So the Buddha refuge, to go to the Buddha refuge is to acknowledge that we have the potential for change, and ultimately we have the potential to transcend craving or grasping, you know, hatred and greed. You know, this as human beings, we have this potential. So the Buddha represents, if you like, a human being. He was a human being. And he represents the potential of human beings. Obviously, unless we've got faith or confidence in this possibility for ourselves, we wouldn't even start on the spiritual life. You know, obviously, this faith or confidence is often not complete, and that's probably how it should be, but we'll leave that aside. The second, the Dharma jewel, refers to the vehicle, if you like, the way in which we practice what we do. So these are the teachings of the Buddha and the people that have come after him, men and women that have practiced deeply through their own experience, come up with effective ways of changing our mind, changing ourselves. And I don't really think it's necessary to say why this is important. Yeah. So sometimes things happen to us quite accidentally. But again, we probably, most of us, I think all of us, need to make kind of consistent effort. And for this effort to be effective, we have to employ effective means. Yeah. So it refers to not only meditation, but study, ethics, reflection. And more broadly, perhaps, even just things like work, the way we live, really. Okay, so the third refuge, and it's the one that we're concerned with this evening, is the Sangha refuge. And the Sangha sometimes is defined in a rather technical way. Sometimes different levels of Sangha are delineated. As I say, these can be rather technical, really, and I'm not going to talk about that this evening or this afternoon. If anybody, just as an aside, actually, I had yesterday a little look at free Buddhist audio, and there's a great number of talks. I think 128 or something talks. If you put in Sangha in the search bar, you get, I think it's 128. I've just made that up, but it was a lot anyway. So there's a lot of talks on Sangha, and some of them, I'm sure, go into this more sort of technical or traditional idea of Sangha. But our own founder, our own teacher, Sangha Ajita, defined Sangha in a very simple and I think quite radical way. And he just said Sangha means the spiritual community. Yeah, the spiritual community. So I think the first thing just to really take on board is that since the time of the Buddha, the spiritual community has been held as one of the three refuges, the three essential elements of the spiritual life. So just the fact that you put them alongside the idea or ideal of enlightenment and the means of achieving that, the sort of vehicle, you put the spiritual community, it just gives us a sense of how important this is, you know, how important it is for us to be part of a community of practitioners. You know. I'm going to come back to this, but I want to take a slightly tangential move at this point. And I want to talk a little bit about Alfred Adler. Some of you, I'm sure, know, have heard of Alfred Adler. Alfred Adler was one of the Sigmund Freud's closest colleagues in the early years. He was part of the original Vienna Circle, which gave rise to psychoanalysis and more generally psychotherapy. And he was the first of Freud's colleagues. He wasn't a student of Freud's, he was a colleague of Freud's. It's quite often said that Adler was a student of Freud's. This is not true. He was a colleague of Freud. And he was the first of Freud's circle to break with him. Yeah? He was the first to go his own way. I think, if my memory serves me right, this was 1911 he broke with Freud. Of course, more famously, perhaps 4 or 5 years later, Carl Jung broke with Freud and went his own way. But I'm not going to talk about Jung today. So Adler is generally regarded as one of the three founding figures of psychotherapy, really. Along with Freud and Jung, Adler is the other sort of founding father of that whole discipline. So I wanted to mention in what, at least one of the ways in which Adler differed from Freud. There's actually a whole... it's quite complicated, actually, but I'm not going to go into it all. I just want to bring out one element of his divergence from Freud. And this can be put, in a way, rather oversimplified, but to rather oversimplify it, we can say that Adler was interested in the exteriority of life. Yeah. So Freud was more or less exclusively interested in interiority. He was only really interested in the sort of lived life of the patient, insofar as it was the arena in which neurotic symptoms manifest. And so they would manifest in your daily life through a Freudian slips or accidents or hysterical symptoms and so on and so forth. And these could, according to Freud, be traced back more or less exclusively to early childhood experiences, mostly up to the age of, usually up to about the age of 3. Okay, so. And other than that, Freud wasn't really interested in the lived life, we could say. On the other hand, in contrast, Adler felt that this was far too limited a perspective on the human being, on the human psyche. He had three basic principles which he said had to be in place for a happy human life, and these were, to paraphrase slightly, were work, love, and community. He said that you couldn't have a happy, healthy psyche without these three elements being in place. It wasn't enough to untie childhood knots. Life had to be manifest, it had to be lived, and it had to be lived through work, through love, and through being in relationship, by being in community. So what Adler realized was that actually the human being, the human mind, us, are formed, we come into being within relationship. It's not just an internal drama. Yeah? Our psyche isn't just some kind of interiority, but in fact is what we could now call an emergent quality. The mind is actually an emergent quality, and it emerges not just for our own inner psyche, but it emerges through our lived life. And it emerges out of community, relationship. So mind is formed in relationship. This is what Adler, well, I don't know if Adler ever said quite that, but that's what I'm, that's how I'm paraphrasing Adler. Yeah. So this is quite a different perspective. Adler went on to influence a whole number of very important other sort of second generation therapists. Mayo, Ellis, Frankel, to name but a few. He also went on to have a profound effect on the development of what we now know as cognitive therapy. So actually, although Adler's probably rather less known than either Freud or Jung, I think in some ways he's had actually more influence. His work has been more influential on the development of psychotherapy. One of the, I think, quite illustrative of Adler's approach as opposed to Freud's approach was that Adler rejected the use of a couch. So anybody that's been in strict Freudian therapy will know that as the, what they call analyze, as the analyst and the...
Analyst.
Yes, I'll not say that. We'll say the patient. traditionally, they would lay on their couch, and the therapist, the analyst, would be positioned behind the head in such a way that they were not couldn't be seen. So this is a sort of theatre of therapy, we could say, and it rendered the therapist or the analyst into a kind of oracle in a way, a kind of mysterious disembodied voice that would interpret sometimes perhaps the what the patient said, and the whole idea was to try and allow the patient to enter into that interiority. In contrast, Adler didn't like this at all and decided he'd just put them both in two normal chairs facing each other. This to us now seems so commonplace it barely seems worth remarking on, but actually the tokens are a radical different perspective on what's going on. Yeah. It's a much more democratic power relationship, and what Adler was interested in was being in relationship with the patient or with the person. Yeah, you wouldn't even use the word patient, I'm sure, but being in relationship with the other individual, being in an actual human relationship with the other individual. So anyway, I just thought I'd mention Adler because one, I find him very interesting, but two, I think he had the same kind of insight that the Buddha had all those hundreds of years before. He realised that our lives are acted out, are played out in relationship. He realised that our external life, our so-called external life, also affects our internal life. That our psyche is somehow formed in relationship. I don't know how else I can put it. I'm sure you get the general idea, yeah? And I think this was the same insight that the Buddha had when he decided that actually without Sangha it would be very hard if not impossible for the vast majority of people to make real progress. Yeah. Some of you might think, but how about the Buddha? You know, the Buddha seemed to have done it on his own. I don't And but I don't know that this is true, actually. The Buddha, actually, or Shakyamuni, Siddhartha, who would become the Buddha, actually had a number of what we could call sanghas after leaving, after leaving the worldly life, his palace life, and going forth and becoming a Shramana, a wanderer. He actually had a number of teachers and was part of the community around those teachers. And then, of course, he had a period of asceticism where he was a member of a little band, a little brotherhood, practicing together in the forest. So he did actually have at least three kind of quite distinctive sanghas or spiritual communities in his journey towards enlightenment. It's true that at some point he went off on his own. And it might well be that at some point in our spiritual lives we find that we need to go off. I was thinking, actually, it's interesting having Karma Shila here, because Karma Shila, at some point, not so long ago, decided to spend some years on his own in Teepee Valley. And so this, you know, this might happen to us, but I don't think that actually implies we can do without Sangha. I think to think we can do without Sangha, at least to begin with, actually throughout, actually, even though we might want certain periods of solitude. To think we can do without Sangha is hubris, yeah. A kind of inflation. And it's a failure to recognize our interpenetration, yeah. Buddhism talks a lot about this sort of interdependence, and while it's quite easy to understand ourselves as physically dependent on the world, that our bodies are quite obviously in the world and quite obviously dependent upon that world. You know, we have to eat, we have to clothe ourselves, we have to shelter ourselves. And for this to happen, we have to be in community to some extent. It's more difficult to understand that our psyche is also in relationship. It's a little bit more difficult to understand. Yeah. In early Buddhism, and actually throughout Buddhism, we are constantly rejoined to remember to keep good company and avoid bad company. Yeah. The Sangha, in a way, is a way of keeping good company. Yeah, and we're very often reminded that we should be very careful who we associate with. And this, again, is because the Buddha realized how easily and deeply we're influenced by other people. Although we might think of ourselves as quite independent and separate, this is not really the case. Unfortunately, you know, anybody that doesn't believe this just has to look at 20th century history. Particularly, but certainly not exclusively, the best example of this is the Nazi Germany. It's a very moving book. I can't remember the author. Called Hitler's Willing Executioners, where the author shows that actually fully a Holocaust to have happened involved hundreds of thousands of normal German people. Yeah, it wasn't done by a few monsters. It was a huge industrial scale operation that involved many, many people. And these weren't inherently bad people any more than we're inherently bad people. So we shouldn't, you know, we should, I think, take these warnings that we find in Buddhism very seriously. That associating who we associate with, the communities we're part of, have a profound influence on us. Yeah. And of course, the opposite is true as well. If we are lucky enough to associate with ethical people, people that are making a real effort to be more human, more humane, this too will have a profound effect on us. Will have a supportive and sustaining effect on us. Yeah. So I think this insight is a very important insight, and without realizing this, we can't really appreciate the importance of Sangha, why Sangha is so important. And this is increasingly difficult for us because we live in such an individualistic age. You know. The whole of society is really trying to con you into believing you are independent, free-thinking individual who really wants to spend ridiculous amounts of money on rubbish. Yeah, this is what it's all about. So, anyway, I digress. So that's Adler, really. So, I wanted to say a little bit about Sangha more particularly then, and I'll do it under the a very sort of traditional way of talking about Sangha. There's something we find called the four means of unification within Buddhism. And these are the ways in which a Sangha is created and maintained. Yeah? They're quite kind of simple and pragmatic, really, and quite, I think, quite useful and easy to understand. So, according to the Buddha, when these four means of unification are present, you will have a kind of healthy and thriving Sangha. When one or more of them is absent, the Sangha is likely to fail, to split, to degenerate. And they are, in no particular order, they are generosity, kindly speech, beneficial activity, and don't tell me. Well, maybe you're going to have to tell me. Exemplification, yeah. Thank you. See, there you go, the 40 years of help. Okay, so I'm just going to say something quite briefly about the four of them, but not too much. And so we'll start off with generosity. Generosity has a very, very particular and important place in Buddhism. Yeah, there's a fourfold path we don't often hear about, which has generosity at the beginning. So it sometimes says that generosity really is the beginning, is at the very beginning of the whole venture. And why it's put at the beginning, one is because it's something, on a pragmatic level, it's something that all of us can practice. Yeah? It's possible to practice generosity. And there's loads of different types of generosity. I'm not going to go into them all. Most importantly, it's kind of, I feel it's generosity with yourself, yeah. It's being generous with yourself, in a way. Which again relates very much to what I was saying. It's realizing that you're a part of a community, and for that community to be healthy and to function, the members of that community need to be generous. Yeah. So generosity is this sort of first movement of the heart towards others. Yeah. It's a kind of initial opening. It's a bit like in the poem, you know. It's that first prayer, if you like, that opens us to faith. Yeah. Something that begins this process of unfoldment. It begins in generosity. And of course, as is always the case, it begins in a way, ends in generosity. In order to be generous, actually, we need to be in community. Yeah? We need to be in relationship. It's quite hard to, well, we can be generous to ourselves, I suppose. if you're on your own, if you're not in meaningful relationship, it's quite hard really to practice generosity. And it is through generosity, of course, that relationship, one of the ways in which relationship, sangha, in this, because we're talking particularly about the relationship within sangha, it's through generosity that these relationships are strengthened and deepened, at least to some extent. The next one, kindly speech, really follows naturally. Yeah? One of the main ways, probably the main way we're in relationship with each other is through speech. This is what human beings do. In a way, I mean, a lot of philosophers, etc., have kind of suggested that what makes human beings unique is this ability for language, Heidegger say? He says, it's a house of belonging, doesn't he? He says, language is a house of belonging. Not quite right. Wittgenstein said something very similar. But so language really forms our world in a lot of ways. We live in a kind of linguistic construction. The world is partly constructed linguistically. This is how we understand the world. But anyway, our relationships. And so kindly speech. I don't know what the... I'm sure Karma Shiva knows, but I'm not going to ask him. I don't know what word has been translated as kindly, but I quite like the English etymology of kindly, actually, in this respect. So, kindly comes from kin. Yeah, kin. And of course, kin means something like family, or tribe, or your group, your people, yeah? Your kin, yeah? So, in this respect, why I like this is that it implies that you understand, because they're your people, they're people that you care about, you understand that these people have an interiority. So I've been talking a little bit about interiority and exteriority, yeah? While we often experience ourselves predominantly as interior, we very often experience others as more or less exclusively exterior. We kind of forget that they have an inner life, which is just as complex, just as vulnerable, just as tender as our own. You know? They're just as fully human as us. And this is surprisingly easy to forget, yeah? And when we forget it, of course, we start to treat people as objects. Yeah? We start to treat other people not as human beings. And so what we've lost here is a sense of kin. Yeah? We've lost a sense of connection based in this act, this basic human act of imagination that we can imagine mind in others. You know, this is that sometimes. We can imagine that others have an interiority, an inner life, have passions and hopes, yeah? Have disappointments and joys, yeah? Feel as deeply as us. Yeah? We can imagine this, and it's this act of imagination that really connects us. So kindly speech is speech in a way that remembers this. Yeah, it remembers other people's interiority. And it's through this remembering of this, the other's interiority that in a way we could say compassion arises. Yeah. We know, oddly enough, well I don't know if it is oddly, I was thinking this the other day, actually, we only ever have to know one person deeply, and that person is ourselves. And when we begin to experience ourselves in our own depth and complexity, we begin to realize this is how everybody is. Yeah? This is how everybody is. And so it's not that we need to know everybody else intimately, but actually through knowing ourselves more and more intimately, we understand other people. Yeah. We understand other people. Yeah. When, the more you are able to sit with, appreciate your kind of, I'm going to use the word sort of vulnerability. I don't mean that in a negative sense at all. Don't see it as at all negative to be vulnerable. Yeah. But when you start to realize, well, the laxness in your own body, the impermanence, the vulnerability, the fragility of what it means to be a human being, which you can only really experience deeply. Well, of course you experience it deeply when a loved one dies, or thing. But actually in the end you need to experience it as pertaining to you. When you really start to realise that this state, this fragile human state, something shared, I think there's a natural movement towards kindness. There's a natural movement towards kindness. And kindness speech is that inaction. Yeah? When we speak kindly to someone in this sense, we affirm them in this way. Yeah? To give attention and speak kindly to someone else affirms them as a human being. And I think we can say, actually, for me, above anything else, doesn't always happen, it's very imperfect, but in a way that's what Sangha should be doing, affirming one another as fully human. If it does that, it does a great deal indeed. Yeah. Much more could be said about speech. I think speech is like a really interesting area in all loads and loads of ways, actually. But I'm not going to say any more about it, really, other than I was going to say one thing, but when I said that thing went out of my mind. Damn. Oh yeah, I was just going to say, not to be confused, kindly speech in this sense also includes truthful speech, but not to be confused with being nice. Yeah, I'm sure none of you do that, but not to be confused with being nice. And this relates back to generosity as well. Actually, I think very often we kind of speak kindly in inverted commas towards people because we want people to like us. You know. We want to be liked. Or we're just too scared, you know. We're just frightened to say to someone, well, actually, that's rubbish what you're doing. Not that we're... you know what I mean. We're sort of scared to say to someone, actually, no, I don't think that's good. I don't think you should be doing that. Or we just go along with someone. And we think we're being kind, but actually, of course, we're just... well, you know what I'm saying, don't you? We're just kind of being complicit in something. Being kind isn't to be complicit in someone's negative or unethical behaviour. No, that isn't kindness. No. You see this more, I mean, anybody that's been a parent knows this very well, yeah? That sort of tension between... being kind to your child, but also trying to set sort of limits and sort of boundaries and give that child a sense of security, actually. Anyway, and I was going to say it's quite related to the preceding one of generosity, because to be truly generous is quite a tricky one. I don't know if it's tricky, but it's not so common, is it, you know, to be truly generous. Very often we do something and this is fine, this is just how it is, you know, we can't expect to be 100% anything, any of the time, I don't think. But I think most of us actually have a very well-developed sort of inner radar when it comes to things like generosity. We kind of know when we're performing an act of generosity because actually we want something back, or we want to be liked, or whatever, yeah. And occasionally we do something which is just completely generous, that has no other motivation. It's just a genuine movement of the heart. And we also all know what that feels like, you know, to act like that. As I say, though, some, you know, it can be quite rare and difficult. We shouldn't worry about it. I'm not suggesting you should worry about, oh, was I really being kind, or was I really being... You know, don't get over self-aware in that sort of way, you know. Don't worry about it. You know, just do your best. Just be kind, just be generous. Sometimes you know, balls it up, that's all right. Sometimes people will react in ways which you don't like. That's okay as well, yeah. We just do our best, but... You know, I think we all know what generosity feels like, you know, we all know what kindness feels like, and we need to kind of trust that, and we also need, and I suppose that's what's relevant for today, we also need a context in which it's safe to experiment with that, to allow ourselves to be generous and kind. Whenever we're kind or really generous, of course, there's a kind of vulnerability. We kind of open ourselves up, yeah? There's a kind of vulnerability there, yeah? When we're very generous or kind, there's a kind of tenderness there, you know, which makes us vulnerable. So we need to have a context in which that will be met with... the same, really, be met by itself. So this is one of the reasons we need Sangha, but it's also one of the ways in which Sangha is created. You know, we create Sangha through acts of generosity and acts of kindness. I won't say much about beneficial activity. I mean, in a way, it's kind of self-explanatory. Yeah. You know, we do things together. We do things that are a benefit for others. It might be a benefit for ourselves as well, you know. So it's the same thing, really, isn't it? It's this movement from a completely self-referential way of being in the world gradually to a way of being in the world which takes full account of others, you know. Maybe not even... We're increasingly, actually, I think we consciously need to extend this not only to human beings, but we consciously need to extend this to the planet, don't we? Because it's in such a sort of shocking state, you know. We really do need to start thinking, well, how is the way I am acting in the world? How is it affecting the world? How is it affecting the world? When I get into my car and drive it, how's that affecting the world? When I take that plane, or when I do this, again, not to become neurotic or about it, but just to really try and see, well, how does my life impact on the world? You know? How does my life impact on the world? And to take that seriously, and then to try and find ways in which your activity in the world, rather than being a negative contribution, becomes a positive contribution to the world. The way you live your life is actually helping, you know, it's actually giving something to the world. In the more restricted sense of the Sangha, well, the same applies, you know. How can we act within the Sangha, which is of benefit for that Sangha, but also, of course, benefit for the world. Lastly, we've got this idea of exemplification, and I find this really interesting idea, this idea of exemplification, and it comes back to what I was saying before, really, that the way people are affects other people profoundly. The way you are affects other people. Yeah. And of course, verse of vice. And I don't think exemplification means that you've got to be perfect, you know. I think what it means is that you've got to try and be as... There's always problems with these words, isn't there? But let's use the word as authentic as possible, yeah. I think what gives people faith and confidence more than anything else is to come across people that seem to be themselves, yeah. Seem to be somewhat comfortable in their own skins and seem to act in a kind of authentic way. I mean, interestingly enough, this kind of brings me right back to my, not about 32 years ago, so not my first contact with what was then can't remember, Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, that's what we were then. My very first retreat, I hadn't had any contact with Buddhism other than through books before that. I went on a 10-day retreat organised by the London Buddhist Centre in East London. One of their big, I think there was about 80 people maybe on it, it was a big summer retreat, 10 days at Seaford. And I was very, very lucky, I think, because actually there was a particularly exceptional team of people on that retreat. So I won't mention them, or just some of them you won't know, but some of you will know people like Siddhi Ratna was on that retreat. Some of you will know Siddhi Ratna. I encountered Siddhi Ratna one day down in the boiler room reading a book on solidarity with a bottle of whiskey. Now, that might not seem like exemplification. That might not seem like exemplification. But actually, for me, here was a guy that was just himself, you know. He was just himself, and there was also a newly ordained paramir, who she got ordained that year. Mm-hmm. And she's still fairly volatile, isn't she, paramir? And she was a lot more volatile in them days. But again, this wonderful Glaswegian woman, you know, her emotions completely kind of on display. Obviously passionate, you know, very passionate about the Dharma. Articulate, and you know, a bit, I was going to use, let's say, messed up in a way, but wonderfully herself, you know, Damarara, and I won't go on, but there was a whole host of people on that retreat that, to me, seemed, I thought, actually, these people are real people, you know, they're not like these religious, you know, they're not kind of fake, you know, they're not kind of playing at being monks or playing at being spiritual. They're genuinely engaged in this sort of collective enterprise. That was the other thing. They were doing something collectively together, you know, they were engaged in this enterprise together, which was obviously meaningful to all of them. Yeah. And it was that, probably more than anything, that encouraged me to become involved. Well, it was that. They encouraged me to become involved in this particular Buddhist organisation. You know. I think Sangharakshita, the founder of this movement, a lot can be said about him. He's an interesting guy. But for me, he did two very important moves, if you like. Firstly, he said that at the heart of Buddhist practice was this idea of going for refuge. This had always been the case, but it had kind of got a bit lost in traditional Buddhism, or it became just the prerogative of the monks or nuns, of a sort of full-time monastic. Yeah, everybody else just, well, they just sort of did what they did. But actually Sangharakshita said, no, at the very heart of Buddhism is this idea of developing confidence and faith in these three jewels. This this act of moving towards, this act of opening the heart towards, placing the heart on. Yeah. So he re-emphasized this in a way that had got quite lost, I think, in most Buddhist groups, cultures. That's one thing he did. And the other thing he did was to say spiritual friendship is of vital importance, yeah. Or sometimes called Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship is an indispensable part of the spiritual life. And this takes us back to this idea that actually we are formed in relationship. When I think of Freud and Adler, I think, oh, actually Adler just knew no man, in brackets, woman, is an island. Adler understood that, where Freud didn't quite understand that. He didn't quite understand what. And the Buddha understood that, and very, very fortunately for us, our own founder, our own teacher, Sangharakshita, understood that. Anyway, I think I might leave it actually. I do. Happy Sangha Day.
Thank you.